Welcome. I'm Halcyon, and this is Hug Nation. It is such a treat to spend this moment with you. Today, I want to talk about revolutionary love. If you have not seen it yet, there is an amazing video by Valerie Kaur where she addresses the post-election landscape, specifically that which is a little bit more closed-minded, a little bit more difficult for people who don't fall into the classifications of privilege. And please go watch her talk. It is filled with insight and passion and beauty, and it pulls at your heartstrings and reminds you of the immigrant story and how important it is for all of us. But she also reaches back to her ancestors and their faith. She is of the Sikh faith, and calls upon and reminds herself of an optimism that says maybe the darkness that we're experiencing right now is not the tomb. Perhaps it is the womb. And I think there's more and more examples of this, of through the difficulty, through the challenge, through the frustration and pain points of this current chapter, rough spots are getting sanded. Deep splinters are coming to the surface. And my friend Wilkes, he said, what did he tell me? He said, perhaps history will look back at Trump as being the piece of sand that got inside the oyster and created a pearl. Hey, I'm all for grabbing onto whatever optimism we can find right now. But this talk that Valerie Kaur gave, and it led to a whole bunch of momentum and started actually an organization called Revolutionary Love and hashtag Revolutionary Love. And there is a whole day planned tomorrow for Valentine's Day. And you might be watching this in a future when Valentine's Day is in the past, so it doesn't matter. There's things that you can do, action items you can do on Valentine's Day, and you can go to revolutionarylove.com and check out what you can do. Or is it .org? I'm not sure. You can search for it. But it's bigger than the day. This is their mission statement that you can actually go to the site and sign and say, I am on board with this. We, people of faith and moral conscience, reclaim Valentine's Day as a day of revolutionary love, day of rising. We resist all executive orders and policies that put people in harm's way. We commit to fight for social justice through the ethic of love, love for others, our opponents, and ourselves. I'm going to say that again. Love for others, our opponents, and ourselves. On Valentine's Day, we will rise up across the USS. We will rise up across the U.S. and around the world in music, poetry, dance, and engage Congress to declare that hashtag revolutionary love is the call of our times. Boom! If you go to the site, at the bottom of it, it has all these organizations of faith, synagogues, temples, churches, all sorts of groups that are unified not in the sacred books, but in love, in the recognition that there is a moral conscience to our country that is above and beyond religion. Yes, we have freedom of religion. Yes, you can practice whatever you want, but if you have lost touch with the compassion and the love of your faith, you have lost your way. I'm reminded of my grandpa Caleb, who, as a Baptist minister, grew up with a little bit of a harshness to his faith and a little bit of a fire and brimstone and a little bit of bigotry in his background growing up in the Dust Belt and just the nature of his surroundings and his history. And through a process of studying and digging in to the teachings and the words of Jesus, he found himself a guide and a light that was deeper and more sure than the teachings of any institution, of any church. And so he found times when he was actually having to break out of the practices of specific organizations and specific dogmas of different churches. And that is what is called for right now. That is what I think anyone who calls himself Christian or anything of faith, like, if your faith is in the way of your compassion, go back to the source. Maybe distrust whatever liaison you have towards the teachings of any prophet or mystic or God. And my grandpa, I remember we had a very powerful, amazing, beautiful Valentine's Day celebration. His last Valentine's Day, he was 94. And it was Valentine's Day 2007. And I kind of knew he was getting to his final chapter. And so we had a party at his retirement village and invited anybody that wanted to come, wear pink. And we all gathered, people brought pink cupcakes, and we all gathered for lunch and then went up to his room, and he gave a little kind of talk about love. And he talked about the three types of love in the Greek terminology. That love is not this vague thing, but it actually is specifically several things. There is phileo love, which is brotherly love, the love you feel towards your friends and your brothers and your sisters, and that bond that you have with family, whether it is blood family or not. There is eros, which is romantic love or sexual love. And that's the love that is often celebrated on Valentine's Day, the love that makes you buy chocolates and flowers and dance under the moonlight. But there is also agape. And agape is divine love. It is the connection, the oneness. It is the recognition of the divine in others. It is that namaste feeling of like, I see the divine in you, you reflect the divine to me. It is what makes gifting work. As you find yourself experiencing the joy of another, as you lift another's burden, you feel that because you are connected, because you are one. That agape love is what I think is being called on in this revolutionary love movement. It is not selfish. It is not protective of you and your own and your family. It is all-inclusive. It is undeniable. And it is that power that spawned the religious movements of the world. It is that beyond the human experience that inspires mystics, that leads us to paths to our absolute truth and our connection with all the other human beings on the planet, and learning to love them despite what they do on a action-by-action basis, but seeing and knowing that we are all instances of a single expression. So I think about Grandpa a lot on Valentine's Day. And I encourage you to take the opportunity of Valentine's Day to celebrate love in your life. Sure, celebrate your romantic partner or partners if you're crafty. And celebrate your phileo relationships of love with your family and your brothers and your sisters and your friends. And dig deep and feel the agape love in this time of fear, in this time of concern, in this time of so often being pushed to a place of fight and rise up. See if you can anchor all of your feelings, all of your emotions, all of your purpose to that agape love, to that light that shines through you. Because when you are connected to that, you are not connected to it. You are it. You are a part of it. And by being a part of it, everyone else is a part of it too. And you have no choice but to lift others up, to be kind, to gift to others. Not out of any sense of guilt or even right or wrong, but out of a sense of selfishness, of protecting all that is good in the world, in a sense of tuning in to truth, because you cannot deny the love, the light that is what this universe is. And when we forget that, when we feel the separation, that's part of the human drama. But when we can remember who we truly are, that's when we can have an effortless floating in the divine stream. And our obstacles can be joyous, and our struggles can be adventurous, and our triumphs can be celebrations of not a selfish achievement, but the working of the cosmic body as a whole, the healthy breathing and thriving of all that is. So, woo-hoo! Let's celebrate revolutionary love. Woo-hoo! Let's celebrate agape love. Woo-hoo! Let's celebrate love for others, our opponents, and ourselves. I love you in the deepest, most profound way. And I am so grateful to share this journey with you. I wanted to touch on a couple political things today. And maybe I'll get a little bit deeper into what I mean by that, but because I think the whole concept of talking about politics is there are at least two divisions of issues that are critical in what is dividing our country right now. And I think that it is detrimental to lump it all into one thing. People, it's very easy to dismiss, I don't want to talk about politics. Politics, in my definition, meaning things like about foreign policy and trade and economics and sanctions and education policies. I mean, politics have logical debates in both sides, usually. I want big government. I think we have small government. You know, I mean, you can make the case in multiple sides of a political argument. You could make the case that we should have, you know, sanctions against Wall Street. You could make the case that we should have tax benefits for Wall Street. You know, you can make those things. But there's a whole nother side to the conversation and the arguments, and what gets lumped into it because politicians force it into it because it's emotional, is there's all these human-based issues, civil rights, bigotry, sexism, and while I'm working really hard to embrace other people's perspectives and listen and being open to political ideology that is different from my own, I have a much harder time having tolerance and understanding for people that are on the other side of issues having to do with bigotry, sexism, compassion, understanding, courtesy. I mean, I talk to people sometimes who are so dismissive of the very conversation about privilege, for example. And I think that maybe the minute people hear privilege, people think like, well, I don't feel like I'm privileged, and so I'm defensive that you're bringing this up. Like, and it's like, okay. And I even, you know, somebody brought up yesterday when I talked about privilege, they were saying, well, I was raised to not see color. And I'm like, okay, you know what? That's a really good point. Whether you think so or not, let's give you that and say, even if you don't see color, do you recognize and acknowledge that the experience of a person of color in America is different than the experience of a white person, or that the experience of a woman in America is different than the experience of a man in America? Like, whether or not you treat people differently, you do see that it's different, right? And that's the part, like, if people say, no, everyone has the same right. Everyone has the ability to lift themselves up by their bootstraps. Like, I mean, yeah, everybody has a chance to win the lottery. But Donald Trump started his empire building with a huge inheritance. Does that make his experience as a businessman different than someone who is highly motivated but broke? Of course. And the experience that both people of color and women have inherent in the experience in America and in the world is that of being judged based on your appearance, and therefore having experiences often with strangers where you, for either for cause or just because of historical experiences, you feel afraid. You feel afraid that something, you're going to be in danger, or someone is going to overpower you, or there's so many examples that you might meet a person of color or a woman who has never been in a situation where they got scared or had cause to be worried. But I think that's rare. And so if you grow up with that fear, with that narrative about what could happen in any time you're in an elevator or a street late at night, it affects your whole identity and your dynamics that you have in the world. If you wander the streets looking for a job and trying to get applications, I mean, it's different if you're a little worried about going into a strange place because you need to be. And especially when they do all this research, like people that have applied for jobs with traditionally black-sounding names versus white-sounding names. So, I mean, hopefully I'm preaching to the choir, but it's one of those things where I'm like, how can we move forward without recognizing what we're dealing with? I'm not saying take blame. I'm not saying you did this. I'm not saying that you need to make any changes. I'm not saying that it's your fault or your ancestors owned slave. No. Let's assume that we're all trying to make things better. Okay. We got to acknowledge that there are things that have been happening and that are currently happening that make the experience harder or scarier or different, so that we can get to a place where we can make them better. And in this landscape that we have right now, where there's been this emboldened voices of racism and bigotry, it's, I think, even more important to recognize that it's not just, these dark spots of racism. There's this institutionalized cultural things, sometimes even legal things throughout history that has made things more challenging. Anyway, my point in all that was that I watched this video there's a series that CNN is doing now, and it's When I First Learned I Was Black. And if you have doubt and you think, we all have it the same, it's super insightful to hear, celebrities and other people talking about when they first had an experience that made them realize, oh my gosh, I'm black and I am being treated differently. It's heartbreaking often, but it's also important to look at, especially if you are unaware of your privilege. Watch all these stories and go, that's never happened to me. Nothing like that has ever happened to me. In fact, I wanted to share a story. When I was just out of college, I was with some really close friends, and we got our hands on some mushrooms, and we went to Balboa Park to enjoy a beautiful day with friends in the sunshine, and we were hanging out on the grass, and giggling and laughing, and at one point, a couple of my friends realized that we just had to get one of these beautiful magnolia flowers off the tree that was in the middle of this kind of park that we were in. And so one of them got another one's shoulders, and they're kind of like, balancing around and trying to like reach up to the lowest flower that they could find. And I just could not stop laughing. I was just like, I just couldn't catch my breath. I was laughing so hard. And I was so, you know, busting up that I didn't notice that storming towards us were two police officers. And they are right out of Central Casting. They've got bushy mustaches. One's dark hair, one's blonde hair. And they're just like raging. And one of them goes, where's the pot? I can smell it. Where's the pot? And we're like, what? And we were not smoking pot. We weren't guilt-free, but we were not smoking pot. And he's like, sit down. You guys sit down, down, down. He puts us into a line and be like, where's the pot? And I was like, and I'm holding this sage that I was just burning. I'm like, it's not pot. I'm burning sage. And he's like, what? I'm like, sage, what? I'm like, it's a Native American healing plant. You burn it to, he goes, what? He's like getting more and more, like, he's just pissed. Like, this hippie is just like, he's just like freaking out. I'm like, and he's like, you're burning things in the park? He's like, you know how stupid that is? You know how stupid it is to be burning things? And we're like, it's very, very stupid. Very stupid. Like, yeah, it's just so stupid. And he's like, what were you doing over there? And my friend's like, oh, we were just picking a flower. He's like, what? Do you realize what would happen if everybody picked a flower? This part. And we're like, he's like, I'm putting you under arrest for destruction of public property. And then, so one of them picks one of our bags and starts going through it. It happened to be the only bag that didn't have pot in it. But, and we're like, what the hell's happening? Is this really happening? And I'm like, you're right, officer. You are so right. We're so stupid. Thank you for telling, we're so stupid. We will never do this again. He's like, that's right. You're stupid. I'm like, we're stupid. And I suddenly realized, like, as I'm acknowledging how smart he is and how stupid we are, that's the game we're playing. And he kind of starts to calm down a little bit as he realizes that, you know, he wins, that we are exposing our jugulars and surrendering. And eventually, after he's thoroughly made us submissive, and we realize that's the game we're playing, is a game of one-sided dominance, you know, he screams us a little bit more and leaves us alone and walks away. We're like, did we almost just get arrested for picking a flower? A friend of mine that was actually in the park was coming to meeting us there. Their claim was that they saw the police going back to their car laughing. But I think back to that experience. And as terrifying as it was, and as important a lesson that I learned, which is that when you are in a conflict with someone in power and authority who is armed, you have to let them win. You have to let them puff their chest and roar. There are times to complain and to file, you know, protests and to argue. But in that moment of a dominant power structure with all the cards asking you or forcing you to be submissive, you be submissive. But I think back at that chapter and that experience as being like, that was as terrifying as it was, as humiliating as it was nothing compared to what pretty much every young Black person experiences at the hands of law enforcement at one point or another. Not that there isn't 98% good cops out there, but at some point you're going to be forced to be submissive. And there's actually, I've seen videos recently online of parents sharing the teaching that they give to their kid on how to act submissively, what to say to diffuse any anger situations that could lead to them being shot, you know, with hands up and saying their full name and, you know, all these. And you know, as funny as that story is in looking at it from the past, it's also a really heavy reminder of my privilege and how even when I had a close call with law enforcement, it still was nothing really risky. I was never really at risk of being imprisoned because I lipped off or was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, needless to say, I have not picked a flower in a public park since. And maybe in that regard, the police did their job, protecting and serving the foliage of this fine city. Vice did this unbelievable little video series where it addressed and looked at Trump shaking hands with dignitaries and with people, just, you know, like one after another. And there was a, you know, one just this week that was incredibly awkward as he was handshaking the leader from China. And you see him all after another. You see how he does this to everybody, where he grabs their hand and pulls them in a total bully move. It's such an obvious power thing that it's like, it kind of makes you sick to your stomach. I can almost picture him like with his knees on someone's shoulder going, "Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself?" I mean, it's that juvenile. And it was cool today to see the video of Trudeau from Canada. Like, he clearly knew this was happening. He clearly had advisors going, "Look, he's going to try to grab your hand and pull you in." And so in the meeting today, Trudeau gets out of his limo. You know, Trump is there with his hand out like, "All right, I'm going to put you in your place, handsome boy." And Trudeau goes out, puts his hand on Trump's shoulder and braces himself. Just goes, "Arr," and you can see them both being like, "God, so embarrassing." And in a less funny thing about politics, and I get that it's some people don't want to talk about it, but this is something just to keep aware of. There's this incredible essay that is going around by Paul Krugman, and he points out a time in our history when a president who barely won due to a Supreme Court decision was in a very unpopular place and what changed everything in terms of public perception and the whole momentum of the presidency and the country was 9/11. And that the parallel between things that are happening now and the things that Trump has been saying that seem to be paving the way towards a reaction towards a terrorist attack or a catastrophe of some sort is like kind of like, "Oh my gosh, I can't, this is like crazy." Like, for example, you know, I was excited last week about the success of the judicial branch finally kind of elbowing its way out of some of the administration's attempt to kind of work around it or depower one of the branches of our three-party system, our three-branch system. And when the appeal was held up and the Muslim ban was not enforceable, Trump tweeted to the world that the judge who made this decision would be to blame if there was ever an attack. If some bad person got into our country and did something bad, that judge was to blame. What? This judge is doing their job. This judge is swore an oath to uphold the Constitution and made a decision doing just that. The fact that you disagree with their decision means you need to use the law to change the law so they can do their job efficiently over and over again. But to say that it's your fault if something happens is kind of, he's letting us know that when something bad happens, I'm going to tell people, "Look, do you want to be safe? Or do you want to follow me? I mean, excuse me, not, do you want to, if you want to be safe, follow me. We gotta get these judges and all these, like, you know, these we've got to eliminate all these steps that are getting in the way of our process of keeping us safe." In the wake of 9/11, we sacrificed freedom for perceived safety. The Patriot Act, there's so much surveillance that happens now that is now legal because of the landscape of fear that was generated. And we are, the road is being paved for that. So I bring it up, not because I'm an expert at it, but because it is something that I find alarming. And the more people that are aware of where we're being led, the more of us can be like, do you see this? Do you see this? Do you see this? Stop walking. In fact, call it out. Because that's some scary stuff. I am, you know, there's a lot that we can bounce back from in terms of policy. But there is real danger when we erode the checks and balances system. Unchecked power is not something that we can just change in the next election because we've sacrificed our ability to fix our own system. So, scary. Oh gosh, there's so many things that I was, well, you know, let me, did anyone watch the Grammys? I don't know if I've gotten old or if it's just the state of the world, but I so enjoyed the Grammys last night. Tribe Called Quest did this like super protest type performance, and there was just a lot that I was just kind of feeling excited by. And I think it's an interesting, I think a lot of it does have to do with the political climate right now, in that we clearly Hollywood and the entertainment industry is for the most part at odds with the current administration. And so it's interesting to see in our culture this incredibly influential force. It's not a political force, but it is a force of influence through music and TV and movies. And it's a global force of influence as it is trying to use its platform to affect hearts and minds. And I think it's kind of interesting. And also along those lines, it's really interesting to see how in the last few weeks we've seen brands using a political stance as a marketing tool, whether it's Lyft saying we're going to spend money on the ACLU, or there was an ad last night for Johnny Walker that was, they played This Land Is Your Land by Chicano Batman, and saying America, keep walking, kind of like, hey. And I just think it's like, of all the things that are going on, that's a kind of an exciting place to have these, the voices of corporations seeing there is a marketing reason to, you know, find which way the crowd is running in terms of public perception and get in front of it, even if it's political, even if it's, I don't know, I don't know if it's purely financial and marketing dollars that is causing it, or if there's some morality that is governing people's decisions, but it's still a very, it's fascinating. Oh, what an interesting time to be alive. I'm just gonna touch on one other thing. Well, maybe, who knows how much I'm gonna touch on. I don't mean to limit myself by math or numbers. You know, speaking of math, has everybody been watching Saturday Night Live? I watched Saturday Night Live live for the first time since I was in high school this week, just to give you an idea of how significant television is becoming in the current world. Maybe that's just to me, but so to see McCarthy's Spicer and to see the Trump impressions, and it's more significant and more powerful than just a bunch of jokes. Like, there's a great video that just came out of Trump's tweets set to emo music. Oh my gosh. And it's not just silly. It's powerful. It affects people's big picture perceptions. Look back, I don't know if you were alive or around during Ford's administration, but there was a popular Ford impression that Chevy Chase did on Saturday Night Live where every time he would give a talk, he would fall and stumble and be, he was like bumbling, and they portrayed him as just like an idiot. That was all based off my understanding of there was a single time when Ford fell or tripped off of a podium. Now, Ford was a college athlete and not a bumbling idiot, but the SNL impression tainted his perception for decades. There's one of my favorite skits is Chevy Chase is, you know, at a press conference and a reporter goes, "Oh, with GDP at X percent and unemployment rising at this percent, what do you think the gross capital reduction is going to be?" And Chevy Chase, as Ford goes, "I was told there would be no math." So keep making jokes. One thing I have not talked about a lot recently is Burning Man. And yes, Burning Man is still a massive, significant part of my life. We are having our monthly meetings as Pink Heart and putting together our plans for 2017. But I wanted to talk about the difference between a festival and Burning Man. People who are new to the Burning Man scene often call it a festival. It is very easy to make that comparison. And in fact, years ago, when there wasn't so many festivals, it was, you could use the words interchangeably. But as there's been more and more and more festivals, and as Burning Man has developed its identity, the distinctions are important. And Burning Man is a tough word to use. You know, is it better to call it a 10 principles event? Because there's events all over the world that follow these events that are not Burning Man. They are events that have other names, like Blazing Swan. Or is it easier to refer to Burning Man as Black Rock City? To me, that's helpful because Burning Man sounds like a festival name, whereas Black Rock City highlights one of the big differences, that it is a city. It is not an event. A festival event is curated by organizers. Organizers get talent and artists and stage makers. They curate and pull together all of the pieces that are going to be the entertainment. Whereas Burning Man, the organizers put together a framework of the city. They put together streets, and they figure out where the porta potties are going to be. And then they advise here and there, but basically they let everybody else fill in what is going to be the entertainment. And they expect everyone to be the entertainment. That significance is massive. The whole sense of identity that one has at a festival versus at Burning Man is different because of that. If you go to a festival, you buy a ticket in exchange for an experience. You are an audience member. You pay money so that you can have entertainers and staff and food vendors provide you with all the things that you need to have an awesome time. Whereas at Burning Man, your ticket is merely like paying the taxes so that the city has the minimal needs met so that the city can function and thrive. You don't get anything back for that. You still got to bring all of your food. You still got to bring all your camping gear and all the things that you want to share with people. You got to be responsible for the entertainment. And that's one thing too, that you are either an entertainer, a volunteer or staff, or your audience when you go to a festival. Granted, more and more there's been opportunities for people at festivals to contribute, you know, with their costumes or dance or signs, and I think that's fantastic. But it's a whole other world than Black Rock City at Burning Man, where you, from the get-go, you are an entertainer, you are an audience member, you are a janitor, you are a medic, you are a tour guide, you play every role, you are a co-host. And so you have a responsibility. If something's on the ground that shouldn't be there, pick it up. If something is missing, add it. If there is disruption, ease it. It's a very different experience than being a receiver of an experience, than being a co-creator of an experience. And it also affects the whole structure of an event. At an event, there's often an area of stages or stage, and then there's an area for camping. And you can establish entertainment or, you know, gathering areas within your camping area, but it is very different than Black Rock City or a Burning Man event, where there is no stages and camping. There is a city, and within the city are places of entertainment, and there's places of gifting, and there's places of eating, and there's places of everything. And it just kind of, it all fills in as it should. Now, you have parts, just like in a city, you have parts of the city that are more highly trafficked, like the city center or the boardwalk, but it isn't, there isn't a, like, you know, it's not like Disneyland and then Disneyland Hotel. It's all together. The reason why it's so significant to just be aware of these differences is because as Burning Man grows, more and more people are discovering it without being brought in from someone who has had the experience and understands this distinction, understands this sense of co-ownership, understands this responsibility and trust that everybody has to kind of co-create together. Otherwise, things fall apart. Too many people not doing their part puts a massive burden on a few. Whereas that is the model of a festival. And if we can help each other understand that, and maybe this is a process, and as festivals grow, that line of participation shifts, which happens at a lot of festivals that I've been a part of, like Lucidity, for example, that needs to be part of the conversation so that there isn't misunderstandings that lead to a collapse of the magic. Because really, a good concert is a good concert, but a magical city? Well, it's magical. So I hope I see you at a gathering of some sort, and we can make magic together. I love you. Can I describe the Burning Man experience in 10 words to those that buy a ticket and have no idea what to expect? Burning Man is a city that you are responsible for. Set up, clean up, hosting, celebration, and love. I don't know. That's an impossible question. It's like, you know, I've been making videos and writing essays about the Burning Man experience and the lessons that I've learned from it for, you know, close to 20 years, and I still struggle because it's like this. It's like, hey, can you describe the Grand Canyon for me? Sure, I could even show you pictures of it, but your experience at the Grand Canyon is going to be nothing like my description and my pictures. Any description of Burning Man is merely a map. It is merely a framework that might make sense once you're there. You're like, oh, this is why this gifting thing is happening here, and this is why, you know, there's this, I feel this expectation in this place, and oh, this is why, you know, this person is so kind to me in this scenario that normally we wouldn't look each other in the eye. That, I see why that's all happening. But until you are in that situation, the description is just like a map. It's just a pamphlet about the Grand Canyon. It's a beautiful day in San Diego. Hopefully it's a beautiful day in your neighborhood. Won't you be? Won't you be? Won't you be my neighbor? Oh, and if you were a San Diegan, Pink Heart is co-hosting an event on March 11th. It's a dance, or you know, music, DJs, and a dance, and it's a fundraiser for First Saturdays. So March 11th at Cava Lounge in San Diego, we're doing a fundraiser for First Saturdays. I'm going to open up the night with a talk, with a Hug Nation talk at 8 o'clock, and then we will have DJs like Jay Kush and Johnny Quest. So that's going to be super fun if you're in San Diego on March 11th. So Thank you so much for being here if you're here live, and thank you for being here if you're in the archive. The whole concept of Hug Nation is that it is a shared intention beyond time and space, and that it is a recalibration. And I know that I am so profoundly grateful for the ability to sink in with like-minded people and realign the heart to our highest selves, our best selves, our most loving selves, our selves that is most in line with agape. Speaking of all of that, we didn't do a hug yet, did we? I keep doing this. I keep getting so excited that I forget to do a hug. Yay! So grab yourselves by the shoulders. And as you squeeze this body, imagine that you are squeezing all the people that are listening at this time, all the people that have listened and that will listen, and that you're squeezing all the people that you've encountered in your life in the last week, on the street, in your house, in the office. Just forgiving them and loving them, seeing the divine beauty as they are a reflection of humanity and divinity to you. And then feel that those arms squeezing you are all of their arms, reflecting that right back, loving you, forgiving you, embracing you as part of the one. And we'll take three breaths together as being a part of that oneness, inhaling through the nose and out through the mouth. Ready? Inhale. Last one, and then sigh it out. On behalf of Grandpa Caleb and all the love warriors, happy Hug Nation. I love you. Yay! Whee! Broadcast live. If you're watching this at a different time, then you're watching the archive, and that's amazing. Technology has bottled up this experience, this now moment. Time traveled it to your now moment. It's now our now moment, regardless of where we are in time and space.